Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 24th Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Russia attacks Ukraine. Explosions before dawn in Kyiv, Kharkiv, Odessa. By Dasha Litanova, Yuris Karmanu, and Jim Hines, the Associated Press. Contract negotiations. Double-digit raises are likely, RTD Union says. By John Murray. Legislature. Dems uncertain what bill on fentanyl should include. By Alex Burness and Elise Schmelzer. City ending vaccine mandate. Denver employees, teachers, and others in high-risk settings had to get the shots. By Taylor Shaw. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Russia attacks Ukraine. Explosions before dawn in Kyiv, Kharkiv, Odessa. By Dasha Litanova, Yuris Karmanu, and Jim Hines. The Associated Press. Byline, Moscow. Russian troops launched their anticipated attack on Ukraine on Thursday as President Vladimir Putin cast aside international condemnation and sanctions, warning other countries that any attempt to interfere would lead to consequences you have never seen. Big explosions were heard before dawn in Kyiv, Kharkiv, and Odessa, as world leaders decried the start of a Russian invasion that could cause massive casualties and topple Ukraine's democratically elected government. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky introduced martial law, saying Russia has targeted Ukraine's military infrastructure. Zelensky said he had just talked to President Joe Biden and the U.S. was rallying international support for Ukraine. He urged Ukrainians to stay home and not to panic. Biden pledged new sanctions meant to punish Russia for an act of aggression that the international community had for weeks anticipated but could not prevent through diplomacy. Putin justified it all in a televised address, asserting the attack was needed to protect civilians in eastern Ukraine, a false claim the U.S. had predicted he would make as a pretext for the invasion. He accused the U.S. and its allies of ignoring Russia's demand to prevent Ukraine from joining NATO and offer Moscow security guarantees, and credulously claimed that Russia doesn't intend to occupy Ukraine, but will move to demilitarize it and bring those who committed crimes to justice. Biden, in a written statement, condemned the unprovoked and unjustified attack on Ukraine, and he promised the U.S. and its allies will hold Russia accountable. Biden said he planned to speak to Americans today after a meeting of the Group of Seven leaders. More sanctions against Russia were expected to be announced today. Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba described the action as a full-scale invasion of Ukraine and a war of aggression, adding, "Ukraine will defend itself and will win. The world can and must stop Putin. The time to act is now." The Russian military said it has struck Ukrainian air bases and other military assets and hasn't targeted populated areas. The Russian Defense Ministry statement said the military is using precise weapons to target Ukrainian air bases, air defense assets, and other military infrastructure. It claimed that there is no threat to civilian population. Anton Gerashenko, an advisor to Ukraine's interior minister, said the Russian military has launched missile strikes on Ukrainian military command facilities, air bases, and military depots in Kyiv, Kharkiv, and Dnipro. After the initial explosions in Kyiv, people could be heard shouting in the streets. But then a sense of normality returned, with cars circulating and people walking in the streets as a pre-dawn commute appeared to be starting in relative calm. Beyond casualties that could overwhelm Ukraine's government, the consequences of the conflict and resulting sanctions levied on Russia could reverberate throughout the world, affecting energy supplies in Europe, jolting global financial markets, and threatening the post-Cold War balance on the continent. Asian stock markets plunged, and oil prices surged after the military action got underway. Anticipating international condemnation and countermeasures, Putin issued a stark warning to other countries not to meddle, saying, "Whoever tries to impede us, let alone create threats for our country and its people, must know that the Russian response will be immediate and lead to the consequences you have never seen in history." Putin urged Ukrainian servicemen to immediately put down arms and go home. In a stark reminder of Russia's nuclear power, Putin warned that no one should have any doubts that a direct attack on our country will lead to the destruction and horrible consequences for any potential aggressor. Although the U.S. on Tuesday announced the repositioning of forces around the Baltics, Biden has said he will not send in troops to fight Russia. Putin announced the military operation after the Kremlin said rebels in eastern Ukraine asked Russia for military assistance to help fend off Ukrainian aggression, an announcement that the White House said was a false flag operation by Moscow to offer up a pretext for an invasion. Putin's announcement came just hours after the Ukrainian president rejected Moscow's claims that his country poses a threat to Russia and made a passionate last-minute plea for peace. "The people of Ukraine and the government of Ukraine want peace," Zelensky said in an emotional overnight address, speaking in Russian in a direct appeal to Russian citizens. "But if we come under attack, if we face an attempt to take away our country, our freedom, our lives, and lives of our children, we will defend ourselves. When you attack us, you will see our faces, not our backs." Zelensky said that he asked to arrange a call with Putin late Wednesday, but the Kremlin did not respond. Anxiety about an imminent Russian offensive soared after Putin recognized the separatist region's independence on Monday, endorsed the deployment of troops to the rebel territories, and received parliamentary approval to use military force outside the country. The West responded with sanctions. Contract negotiations. Double-digit raises are likely, RTD union says. Transit agency has struggled with worker shortages, by John Murray, the Denver Post. The regional transportation district is poised to give raises amounting to more than 25% over 3 years to its union-covered employees as contract negotiations near the finish line, according to a union bulletin sent to members Wednesday. Metro Denver's transit agency has faced shortages among bus and train operators and other employees for years, with some of the gaps worsening during the pandemic, as the Denver Post recently reported as part of a three-day series. These shortages have been the top hurdle to restoring more service to RTD's pandemic-reduced schedule as ridership recovers. Deborah Johnson, the agency's CEO and general manager, has said publicly that higher wages are needed to compete with other public and private employers for drivers and skilled workers, and to keep employees from leaving. Although the contract proposal is not official yet, the union's new bulletin offers a first look at potential wage increases. The across-the-board raises would start at more than 16% this year, plus 4% in each of the next 2 years, the bulletin says. If those take effect, bus and train operators' current $20.58 per hour starting pay would increase to about $24 initially. The hourly rate would end up at nearly $26 by 2024. mechanics, $26.08 an hour starting pay, would increase to about $30 this year and nearly $33 by 2024. The current Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1001 contract is set to expire February 28th, but the union bulletin says the initial pay increases would be retroactive to January 1st. RTD spokeswoman Marta Sepecki declined to comment Wednesday about contract specifics. "We just can't comment on something that's not finalized," she said. "We're pleased with the progress and the collaboration between RTD and the union." In an interview with the Denver Post, local ATU president Lance Langenbaum characterized the annual raises and other details cited in the bulletin as tentative agreements with RTD's negotiating team. He declined to speak about the contract as a whole until it's finalized. "The negotiations are basically done," he said. "It's just a matter of a final review to make sure we have everything in place. Once finalized, the proposed contract will go to the union's members and RTD's elected board for ratification." The ATU Locals Bulletin cited another provision that would give an incentive for voting yes, a $500 after-tax bonus. Other tentative provisions cited in the bulletin include enshrining double-time overtime pay for operators and engineers in the contract, increasing pension calculations based on years of service, and the development of an apprenticeship program. It's unclear what the pay raises and other provisions would cost RTD if they were approved in a new contract, but RTD leaders have said they budgeted for those likely costs in this year's $771 million operating budget, although they didn't disclose any of the projected amounts during the budget process last fall. RTD has 2,141 budgeted positions in jobs represented by the union out of 3,128 total. Many of its union job classifications have substantial vacancies, including 183 unfilled bus operator jobs, 19.2% as of last month, and 11 light rail operator jobs, 6% as of December. The agency also contracts out operation of some bus routes and train lines to private operators that employ about 1,300 people. Some of those jobs are covered by separate union contracts. RTD officials, employees, and the union president told the Post for its recent series that low pay was a major hurdle to hiring and retaining more employees in a competitive environment. But it's not the only one. RTD also has struggled to address employees' safety concerns, scheduling problems, and other challenges. Legislature. Dems uncertain what bill on fentanyl should include, by Alex Burness and Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. There appears to be unanimous agreement among state lawmakers, Attorney General Phil Weiser, Governor Jared Polis, law enforcement, harm reduction experts, and others about the need to better protect Coloradans from fentanyl, the drug accelerating the state's crisis of overdose deaths. At least 767 people died of fentanyl overdoses in Colorado in 2021, although delays in state data reporting mean the real number is likely higher. Even with 3 months of data incomplete, that's a 42% increase from 2020. On Sunday, five people, all young adults no older than 32, died of suspected fentanyl overdoses in Commerce City. "Everybody wants people to stop dying," said Denver Democratic State Senator Robert Rodriguez on Wednesday. Yet 43 days into Colorado's legislative session, no lawmaker has introduced a bill to address the fentanyl crisis. On the state Senate floor Wednesday, Bob Gardner, a Republican from Colorado Springs, excoriated his Democratic colleagues who control the legislature for not having produced a bill yet. "I thought in December and January, when the governor, the attorney, and members of this chamber had press conferences and said we must do something about the fentanyl crisis, that surely within 2 or 3 weeks of convening, we would see a bill or bills moving through the General Assembly to solve this problem," Gardner said. "But here we are, and I hear that people meet and meet and meet, and yet nothing has happened. There is no bill introduced. He waved in his hand a drafted bill to toughen penalties on crimes related to fentanyl distribution and production, and said he would seek permission from chamber leadership to introduce it. This is not a typical way to get a bill moving, and Gardner's move is unlikely to produce real legislation. But his point was made. Why was it not done in January? He asked reporters after his speech. The short answer is that the Democrats who hold majorities in this Capitol and decide which bills live and die aren't yet certain what they want the bill to look like. House Speaker Alec Garnett, a Denver Democrat, is leading these talks, acting as something of a project manager on a drafting process that he said has involved hundreds of hours of meetings among elected officials, police, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and addiction experts. His essential challenge, he said, is to write a policy that limits the distribution of this poison without landing users in jail. Fentanyl is an extremely potent synthetic opioid. 2 milligrams of the substance can be fatal, according to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. The opioid has been used legally as a painkiller, but the fentanyl causing hundreds of overdose deaths in Colorado is almost always illicitly created in unauthorized drug mills and sold illegally, according to law enforcement. The illicit fentanyl is cheaper to produce than other drugs and can be ingested and sold to unsuspecting customers who think they are buying cocaine, heroin, or prescription painkillers, experts have said. For those knowingly using the substance, it is particularly addictive, dangerous, and difficult to treat. Garnett noted that Gardner and every other Colorado legislator, Democrat and Republican alike, has the right to introduce 5 bills per session, and that as of day 43, none have filed anything on the topic. I'm tired of everybody pointing fingers at each other, and I'm trying to drive a conversation to get at a true comprehensive solution to the best of the state's ability to attack fentanyl and prevent people from dying, Garnett said Wednesday. He added, we can do this in an innovative way. Putting addicts in jail isn't a public policy solution that has been proven by the data over a long period. With the aspect of the bill concerning criminal penalties still not set, Garnett and others continue to workshop. He said a bill will soon be introduced, but didn't commit to a date. Other parts of the bill should be much less complex. For one, lawmakers plan to expand access to Narcan, the life-saving nasal spray that can act as an antidote for people overdosing on fentanyl, among other deadly drugs. Lawmakers also want to make fentanyl testing strips widely available throughout the state. At concert venues, in vending machines, said Representative Leslie Herod, a Denver Democrat who is also working on the policy. Denver already has a program to send Narcan and test strips to people who request them. People who are accidentally ingesting this poison should not be considered felons if they survive the overdose that's about to come to them, Herod said. What we need to look at is how we provide more resources for harm reduction and how we provide more resources to investigate and to throw the book at the actual high-level drug dealer that's bringing in the fentanyl that people are using to cut the drugs and then sell. Herod, along with 2 Republicans and another Democrat, was a lead sponsor of a 2019 law to lessen penalties for drug possession. This law has been blamed widely by Republicans, big city mayors, and law enforcement officials in particular, for softening the state's position on fentanyl and facilitating distribution and death. The law, House Bill 191263, didn't drastically alter fentanyl penalties, however, nor stop police from seizing fentanyl or arresting people who possess or sell it. Rather, it changed the possession of up to 4 grams of fentanyl and all other Class 2 substances from a Level 4 drug felony, the lowest level drug felony, to a Level 1 drug misdemeanor. The maximum sentence between the misdemeanor and the felony differs by 6 months. Under Colorado law, the presumptive sentence for a Level 4 drug felony is 6 months to 1 year in prison, with up to a year on parole. If there are aggravating factors, like being on probation or parole for another felony, the sentencing range is 1 to 2 years in prison with up to 1 year of parole. Level 1 drug misdemeanors are punishable by up to 180 days in jail and 2 years of probation. People with 2 previous Level 1 drug misdemeanor convictions can be sentenced to up to a year in jail, and people with 4 or more such convictions can be charged with a Level 4 drug felony. Prior to the law change, the average person's sentence for a Level 4 drug felony was 4.8 months, with an average of 9.6 months of subsequent parole, according to a fiscal analysis of the bill compiled by the nonpartisan Legislative Council staff. The 4-gram weight limit applies to pure and compound substances alike. That means 4 grams of pure fentanyl is treated the same as 4 grams of pills containing a few micrograms of fentanyl. The Democrats brainstorming now on fentanyl policy are mostly not interested in just undoing portions of the 2019 law. Meeting with reporters Tuesday, Garnett snapped at a television journalist who suggested, in a question about fentanyl, that Democrats are responsible for HB 19-1263. In fact, that bill was bipartisan. 6 Senate Republicans, including Minority Leader Chris Hulbert, voted for it, and its lead sponsors included a Republican former cop and a Republican bail bondswoman. Garnett told reporters that narratives, journalistic or otherwise, suggesting Democrats alone passed that bill are getting to a point where it's misleading the public. His counterpart in the state Senate, Boulder Democrat Steve Fenberg, said one reason his party is taking time to introduce a bill is that they don't want to invite more of what they've already seen from Republicans. You could introduce a bill prematurely. I don't think it'll actually result in the bill passing sooner. I'd rather introduce a bill that has buy-in and can move through the process fairly quick, he said. The Republicans will politicize it if we drop a ball prematurely. They will nitpick it. We want to make sure there's buy-in and that we're actually introducing the right policy so that, frankly, Republicans can't make a political football when we're talking about such a sensitive topic and people dying. What Gardner did today, I think, is wrong. City ending vaccine mandate. Denver employees, teachers, and others in high-risk settings had to get the shots. By Taylor Shaw, The Denver Post. Denver will no longer require city employees, school teachers, contractors, and workers in high-risk settings to be vaccinated against COVID-19 beginning March 5th, the city's Department of Public Health and Environment announced Wednesday. The health department cited lower COVID-19 positivity rates, the stabilization of hospital capacity levels, and lower risk of severe disease from the virus as reasons for ending the city's vaccine mandate enacted last summer. These improved community outcomes, in addition to vaccinations and boosters being free and widely available to the public, now make it possible to transition to a longer-term approach that treats COVID-19 as an endemic disease and reserves public health orders for urgent situations, the department said in a news release. The city's public health order that required COVID-19 vaccinations for Denver's employees and contractors, as well as private sector workers in high-risk settings, such as public and private schools, homeless shelters, and jails, was announced August 2nd with a vaccination deadline of September 30th. Denver Public Schools Superintendent Alex Marrero stated that 87% of the district's employees were fully vaccinated by September 30th. That number has since increased to 96% of employees, said Will Jones, the director of external communications, in a statement Wednesday. Jones said an additional 4% of employees had received medical and religious accommodations. However, Denver Public Schools did terminate 26 employees, the equivalent of 0.01% of its workforce, effective January 2nd for non-compliance with the public health order, Jones said. The district has 10,177 full-time employees, including 4,780 classroom teachers, according to its website. Termination was our last resort after months. October 23rd to January 1st, of working together to resolve problems, understand barriers, and ensure that the school district aligned to regulations on medical and religious accommodations, Jones wrote. Nearly 99% of Denver's employees complied with the public health order before the September 30th deadline. Out of 10,700 Denver employees, 32 were terminated for not complying with the public health order, said Mike Strott, the deputy communications director of Mayor Michael Hancock's office, in a statement Wednesday. 24 employees were let go for vaccine noncompliance and 8 for exemption noncompliance, Strott said. People who were terminated are not eligible for rehire for 5 years, per the career service rules, Strott said. I want to thank everyone who complied with this mandate. By taking the step to be vaccinated and staying up to date on boosters, you have kept our hospital system from collapsing and have saved lives, Denver Public Health Administrator Bob McDonald said in the Public Health Department's statement. Denver is now a place where it makes sense to lift the vaccine mandate. According to Denver's Public Health Department, as of Wednesday, the one-week positivity rate of COVID-19 tests in Denver had dropped below 5%, and modeling suggests lifting the vaccine mandate won't have a negative impact on that downward trend. The Public Health Department also estimated 90% of Coloradans are immune to the Omicron variant through vaccination or infection, and there is a low incidence of severe disease from COVID-19 for people who are vaccinated and boosted and for children under 5. Although the city's vaccine mandate will be lifted, the department said staying up to date on COVID-19 vaccinations and boosters is the best way to protect against severe disease, stating data from the Omicron surge in Denver showed people who are boosted are 86% less likely to die and 51% less likely to be hospitalized compared with someone who has gotten a COVID-19 vaccination but not a booster. Federal and state vaccination mandates are still in effect for personnel in certain settings, such as medical facilities. The state still requires the COVID-19 vaccine for healthcare workers who interact with patients, and state employees must be fully vaccinated or participate in twice-weekly testing, according to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment's website. Residents can visit Denver's Get a Vaccine website to find out where to get free vaccines without having to provide insurance or identification information. Westminster. Firefighters respond to explosion and fire at townhome complex, by Kiernan Nicholson, the Denver Post. A two-story townhome in Westminster exploded Wednesday afternoon, and dozens of firefighters doused a smoky fire with temperatures in the mid-teens. The incident happened about 1:35 p.m. in the 8300 block of Sheridan Boulevard in the Stratus Townhomes Complex, according to the Westminster Fire Department. James Squall, a resident who lives close to the destroyed building, was getting ready to eat a late lunch when he heard a big boom. I came out and the whole side of the building was going up in flames and smoke, Squall said. People were running around screaming and dogs were loose, Squall said. It was pure pandemonium. Squalls went and checked on a neighbor, a senior resident, and made sure she was okay. 4 buildings at the complex were evacuated as a safety precaution, and 8 townhomes, all part of the same building, were directly affected by the incident, according to the fire department. 2 people were treated for minor injuries on scene, and all residents were accounted for by emergency responders. A firefighter suffered a minor injury and was treated at a hospital. Cora Walters, who has lived at the complex for 9 years, said she heard a bang, initially thinking it was a gunshot or noise from nearby railroad tracks. She checked outside her home, saw heavy smoke, and called 911. "You guys got to get out here fast because it looks bad," Walters recalled telling a dispatcher. She alerted her 2 brothers and her mother. They gathered 2 pets and found safety and shelter in the complex clubhouse area. Walters lives in one of the buildings that was under mandatory evacuation. Westminster, Arvada, and Adams County Fire Departments responded to the fire and explosion. The cause of the incident remains under investigation. Contractors were working on-site Wednesday, and Xcel Energy inspected other buildings at the complex, which included temporary shutdowns of utilities and power, according to a Westminster News release. During the fire, an investigator could be seen taking photographs of a furnace and a central air conditioning unit that had been placed on a sidewalk along a parking lot near the building that had exploded and caught fire. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives is assisting in the investigation into the cause, according to police. Federal investigators are helping based on a strong working relationship with local investigators. Northbound lanes of Sheridan were shut down from West 80th to West 88th Avenues during the afternoon by the incident. Early Tuesday morning, an explosion destroyed a single-family home in the 7700 block of Knox Court, Westminster, where human remains were found in the rubble. That incident is also undergoing investigation. Authorities do not believe that the two incidents are connected, police said. Table Mesa King Soopers State Hospital issues update on shooting suspect by Mitchell Byers, the Daily Camera. A judge has withdrawn the order for a representative of the state hospital to appear in court after attorneys received a written update on the status of the King Soopers shooting suspect. Ahmad Al-Alawi Alyssa, 22, is charged with 10 counts of first-degree murder, 47 counts of attempted first-degree murder, one count of first-degree assault, 10 counts of felony possession of a prohibited large-capacity magazine, and 47 crime of violence sentence enhancers. Boulder Chief Judge Ingrid Bakke formally declared Alyssa incompetent to proceed after evaluations from four doctors who all found he was not capable of assisting in his own defense. Bakke issued a mental health stay on the case and ordered Alyssa to undergo restoration efforts at the state hospital in Pueblo and ordered the state hospital to provide updates every 30 days. But the Boulder County District Attorney's Office filed a motion last week indicating the hospital had not provided any updates on Alyssa's progress, and Bakke issued an order for a representative for the Colorado Mental Health Institute to appear on March 10th to address the failure to comply with the court's order. In a release Wednesday, the district attorney's office indicated the state hospital issued a written update on Alyssa's status after the court order, and it was rescinding its request for the March 10th court appearance. The goal is to avoid unnecessary delay in having the defendant deemed competent to stand trial, Boulder District Attorney Michael Doherty said in a statement. We appreciate that the state hospital provided this written progress report pursuant to the court's order. The written update itself was not made public. Alyssa's next court date is March 15th for a review hearing. According to an arrest affidavit, police were called to the King Soopers at 3600 Table Mesa Drive at 2:40 p.m. March 22nd for a report of an armed man who had shot a person in a vehicle in the store's parking lot and was inside the store. Eric Talley, a 51-year-old Boulder police officer, was the first to arrive on scene and was shot and killed. Police said Alyssa fired at other responding officers before one of the responding officers shot Alyssa in the leg. Alyssa later surrendered to police. Police found weapons and tactical body armor at the scene, according to the affidavit. In addition to Tally, Denny Stong, 20, Nevin Stanisic, 23, Ricky Olds, 25, Trelana Bartowiak, 49, Terry Liker, 51, Suzanne Fountain, 59, Kevin Mahoney, 61, Lynn Murray, 62, and Jody Waters, 65, were killed in the shooting. Jeffco Public Schools, ex-Dougco administrator hired on temporary basis by Jessica Seaman, The Denver Post. Jeffco Public Schools has temporarily hired Corey Wise, the superintendent fired by the school board in nearby Douglas County School District earlier this month. Wise has joined the district as a community superintendent for the remainder of the school year. The person who previously held the job was recently hired as Jeffco Public Schools' chief of schools, said spokeswoman Maggie Wells in an email. We are fortunate to have an experienced leader joining the team to provide support to our schools and principals during a time of transition, she said in the statement. Douglas County's School District's Board of Education fired Wise without cause during a dramatic meeting February 4th. The board was deeply divided in the vote to terminate Wise's contract 2 years before it was set to expire in 2024. But the four newly elected directors who have majority said they wanted to take the district in a new direction and did not feel supported by the then superintendent. Wise, who had worked in Douglas County School District for more than two decades, served as its interim superintendent for 6 months before he was chosen to take the job full-time in April. Douglas County Schools Board sets a timeline for new superintendent hire by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. If all goes to the school board's plan, the Douglas County School District could have a new superintendent by the end of next month. The district's Board of Education approved a timeline Tuesday that will have it select one or more finalists for the position next week and potentially offer a candidate the job March 22nd. Last week, Board President Mike Peterson said he wanted to move quickly to fill the job and bring stability back to the district, which serves more than 63,000 students and has been in turmoil since the board fired former Superintendent Corey Wise in a heated meeting February 4th. I was comfortable with this timeline because it still gave plenty of time for feedback from students, staff, community, everyone, said Christy Williams, the board's vice president, who voted in favor of the timeline. Peterson initially proposed a timeline that would have had the board voting on finalists Thursday, but members decided to wait. The amended timeline still drew criticism from the board's three minority members last week, but passed on a 4-3 vote on Tuesday. I don't think the proposed timeline is adequate for the position of superintendent, said board member Elizabeth Hansen, who voted no. The board made small tweaks to the proposed timeline, including adding a flex day on March 2nd in case they need an extra day to screen candidates. The board's directors debated whether they will vote on finalists during the screening process or on March 3rd, when they are supposed to interview finalists publicly. The hiring of a new superintendent comes more than 2 months after the school board shifted to the right following the election of four new members in November. They hold the majority on the seven-member board and have sought changes in the district, including no longer requiring masks in schools, asking for a review of the equity policy, and firing Wise. The decision to fire Wise sparked protests by hundreds of teachers and students, and the three minority members have alleged the other four directors' members violated state open meeting laws when they discussed replacing him as superintendent. The directors who hold the majority, including Peterson, have said they followed the law. The Douglas County School District's two deputy superintendents, Andy Abner and Danelle Hyatt, have shared the role of acting superintendent since Wise's termination. About eight people have applied so far for the superintendent position, Peterson said. One person has been mentioned as a potential replacement for Wise, Aaron Kane, a former interim superintendent for the district. Peterson acknowledged last week that he already reached out to Kane about the job, and Williams said she also supported her applying. Kane, executive director of American Academy, has not yet applied for the superintendent job, said Michelle Quintana, communications manager for the charter school, in an email. Kane sent a letter to American Academy parents February 17th, confirming Peterson asked her to apply for the job and saying that she was honored to be asked. As you all know, I love our school district. The 2 years I spent leading Douglas County Schools through a very challenging and divisive time was one of the most difficult and rewarding experiences of my career, Kane wrote in the letter. I am committed to helping us move forward to a brighter future, whether leading American Academy or our district if given the opportunity. Boebert's newest Democratic challenger, Walker announces campaign with video of flying cow pies by Conrad Swanson, the Denver Post. The video starts with a flurry of flying feces. A cow pie crushes one woman and others run to take cover. In the aftermath, political newcomer and Democrat Alex Walker picks up a sullied teddy bear and announces he's joining the crowded race to unseat Republican U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert of Sylt. We are real Coloradans. We deserve a living wage, small government that actually works, and freedom of choice, Walker said. Instead, we have bull expletive. The source of the barnyard epithet is incumbent Boebert, Walker's video insinuates. An actress representing the congresswoman laughs maniacally and sprays her office with a murky substance. Walker is shown passing out towels. Boebert's comments and claims in public and on social media have ushered her to the forefront of the Republican Party, alongside representatives such as Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Matt Gaetz of Florida. They have also drawn the ire of Democrats and moderates. Walker is openly gay, raised by Republican parents in Littleton and Eagle, according to his campaign announcement. He is an entrepreneur and has worked as an engineer. The announcement cites Walker's business experience and the loss of his brother to suicide as reasons for his campaign. Part of why I'm running is to honor my brother and everyone left behind by elected officials who don't do their jobs, the announcement said. I'm 100% committed to stopping Boebert from continuing her endless cycle of attacking people because of who they are or what they look like. Walker is joining a crowded field of Democratic challengers, each of whom has raised only a fraction of the funds Boebert has, campaign finance records show. So far, 10 other Democrats are in the race. Walker makes 11. All those candidates combined have less than 13% of the more than $2 million that Boebert has on hand, according to the most recent set of campaign finance reports. Some have yet to report any cash on hand at all. Boebert has fewer Republican challengers hoping to beat her in the party primary. Among them is seasoned state Senator Don Corum, whom political scientists have said might have the best shot at winning of all the challengers. Ex-UCLA lecturer accused of making threats pleads not guilty, by Colleen Slevin, the Associated Press. A former lecturer at the University of California, Los Angeles, pleaded not guilty in Denver on Wednesday to allegations that he sent emails and posted videos threatening violence against the school. One of Matthew Harris's lawyers, Ed Robinson, entered the plea during a brief hearing in federal court a day after a grand jury indicted Harris for the alleged threats, as well as weapons violations. Harris, who was arrested in Boulder, sat at a table with his two lawyers wearing a surgical mask and jail uniform, but was not asked to speak. Harris's lawyers did not argue against prosecutors' request that he continue to be held behind bars. Harris, 31, is accused of sending emails with an 800-page document and links to videos to people at UCLA. On February 1st, UCLA canceled classroom instruction as a precaution, and Harris was arrested in Boulder, where he had been living in an apartment across the street from the University of Colorado. The indictment alleges Harris also lied about never having been committed to a mental institution to try to buy a handgun and possess ammunition. According to court documents, Harris's mother told authorities he was diagnosed with schizophrenia last year, and she had him involuntarily committed to a psychiatric institution after he allegedly threatened her in April. Both of Harris's new private attorneys, Robinson and Nancy Cardone, said they could not comment on the allegations so early in the case. Harris had lectured in UCLA's philosophy department until being put on investigatory leave last March after allegedly sending pornographic and violent content to his students. Harris previously studied at Duke and Cornell universities. A trail of red flags about his behavior toward women followed him throughout his academic journey to UCLA. In online class reviews, interviews, and emails obtained by the Associated Press, current and former students at all three universities alleged negligence by the schools for letting Harris slide, despite his concerning conduct. Boulder and Longmont, RTD selects consultant to study rail extension plan, by Annie Mell and Kelsey Hammond, The Times Call. The Regional Transportation District on Tuesday announced it selected a consulting firm to study the feasibility of extending rail service from Union Station in Denver to Boulder and Longmont. HDR Incorporated of Omaha has been selected to conduct the RTD's Northwest Rail Peak Service Plan study, according to a news release. After RTD board approval in August, the agency sought proposals from qualified firms for the study, the release said. HDR Incorporated was selected among three firms that submitted proposals. Longmont Mayor Joan Peck said hiring a consultant is the right step for RTD to take. Longmont City Council and the councils of all the municipalities on the Northwest Corridor have been working on the peak service commuter rail service plan for 7 years, she said. It is exciting to see this initial step taken in the planning process. Longmont Transportation Planner Phil Greenwald said the city was involved in the selection process of the consulting team for the feasibility study. The city is excited to start moving forward with this study to determine the most up-to-date costs associated with providing commuter rail service between Longmont, Boulder, Louisville, Broomfield, Westminster, and Denver. The study is expected to take about 2 years to complete and will aim to provide updated engineering and cost estimates to determine service recommendations for communities, including Broomfield, Louisville, Boulder, and Longmont, the release said. Additional goals include positioning the project for federal funding, planning peak service to allow for future build-out of the Northwest Rail Line, and aligning RTD with the agency's goals of partnering with agencies such as the Front Range Passenger Rail Service and the Colorado Department of Transportation. The plan will examine use of RTD's existing B-Line commuter rail, along with the possibility of leasing BNSF railway right-of-way and tracks, to extend service during peak commuting hours from the station in Westminster to Boulder and Longmont, the release said. The peak hour service plan would offer 3 morning trips from Longmont to Denver and 3 evening trips from Denver to Longmont. Even with the consultant for the study selected, the completion of the Northwest Rail is still many years away. RTD's projected completion date for the project is 2050, according to the release. The continuous discussion for the Northwest Rail is a response to pressure from Governor Jared Polis and other Northwest Metro elected officials for the RTD to finish the line, which was promised in the 2004 voter-approved Fast Tracks plan that contemplated a rail connection between Denver Union Station and Longmont. The Northwest Rail Line has the highest price tag of the unfinished Fast Tracks projects and is estimated to cost about $1.5 billion, the release said. But because the plan was approved by voters almost 2 decades ago, millions of Boulder County taxpayer dollars have been collected. From 2005 through 2020, Fast Tracks taxes collected in Boulder County totaled $269.4 million, including about $67.2 million collected in Longmont and about $129.8 million in Boulder, Longmont Chief Financial Officer Jim Golden previously said. In news briefs, officials issue avalanche warning. Snow is pounding parts of Colorado, with the southwestern portion of the state seeing eye-dropping snow accumulations. An avalanche warning is in effect through 6 p.m. today. The alert covers the Colorado Avalanche Information Center's Grand Mesa, Aspen, Gunnison, North San Juan, and South San Juan zones. The Avalanche Center says backcountry conditions are hazardous and that travelers should avoid being in, near, or below avalanche terrain and steep slopes. Heavy snowfall and strong winds produce very dangerous avalanche conditions, forecasters wrote Wednesday. Large avalanches will be very easy to trigger, and some will run naturally. Travel in backcountry avalanche terrain is not recommended. Man shot dead by deputy outside a middle school. A Pueblo County Sheriff's deputy shot a man dead outside a middle school Tuesday when the pair got into a scuffle and the man attempted to take the deputy's gun, authorities said. About 3:20 p.m., deputies were called to Liberty Point International. where a man was knocking on vehicle windows in the area, the sheriff's office said. A deputy approached the man, and a scuffle ensued, with the suspect trying to take the deputy's gun, the release said. Shots were fired, and the man died at the scene. The deputy was taken to a hospital to be treated for injuries. No students or staff members of the school were involved in the incident, the sheriff's office said. The coroner's office will release the identity of the man who was shot. The deputy's name was not released. The 10th Judicial Critical Incident Response Team is investigating. Boulder completes Anemone Loop Trail. Boulder has completed work on the new Anemone Loop Trail, a 3-mile loop trail west of downtown. The city has lifted construction-related trail closures, and the Anemone Loop Trail is now open 7 days a week. According to a news release, the project, built by Timberline Trail Craft, has been in the works since May 2020. It includes the construction of short spur trails off the main loop, the restoration of native vegetation, and the use of sustainable trail design to minimize erosion. City regulations require people to stay on the trail and not walk off the path. Visit osmptrails.org to view a map of the new trail, which can be accessed from the Centennial or the People's Crossing trailheads, the release states. Police investigate body found near park, byline Longmont. Police confirmed on Monday that a body was recovered near Sandstone Ranch Park last week, but they could not release any details until the Boulder County Coroner's Office shares its report on the investigation. According to Longmont Police spokeswoman Robin Erickson, a man flagged down a Longmont officer about 5:15 p.m. February 13th. The man told the officer he thought he found a body south of Sandstone Ranch and took the officer to the location. Erickson said the officer was in city limits when flagged down, but she didn't know the exact location of the body. Bobby Lee, the wife of a man missing since September, wrote in a February 13th Facebook post, the remains were the body of her husband, Saza Lee. The 54-year-old disappeared after an evening bike ride September 10th along the St. Vrain Greenway. These news briefs were from staff and wire reports. Ivanka Trump in talks with January 6th panel about cooperating with inquiry by Annie Carney and Luke Broadwider, the New York Times Company, byline Washington. Ivanka Trump, former President Donald Trump's eldest daughter who served as one of his senior advisors, is in talks with the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol about the possibility of cooperating with the panel, according to two people familiar with the discussions. It was not immediately clear whether the negotiations, which aides describe as preliminary, would result in Ivanka Trump providing substantive information to the panel or whether they were simply a stalling tactic, as some committee aides fear. But it was the latest example of the panel trying to reach into the former president's inner circle to ascertain what he was doing and saying as rioters stormed the Capitol in his name. Ivanka Trump was one of several aides who tried and failed to persuade Donald Trump to call off the violence that ultimately injured more than 150 police officers and sent lawmakers and the vice president, Mike Pence, fleeing for their lives. Ivanka Trump's lawyers have been in talks with the committee since January, when the panel sent her a letter requesting that she give voluntary testimony, according to a person familiar with the discussions. She has yet to agree on a date when she might talk with the committee's investigators, and the panel has made no threat of an imminent subpoena, the people familiar with the discussion said. Those close to Ivanka Trump said she had no intention of going down the road taken by her father's ally, Steve Bannon, who refused to cooperate with the committee and was indicted on contempt of Congress charges. Ivanka Trump is in discussions with the committee to voluntarily appear for an interview, a spokesperson for her confirmed Wednesday. Donald Trump has not requested that his daughter defy the committee's requests, as he has done with his other former top aides. And Ivanka Trump would be unlikely to take any step that Donald Trump did not know about and approve of, people familiar with her thinking said. Instead, the former president has portrayed his adult children as victims of an investigation that he has dismissed as illegitimate. It's a very unfair situation for my children, Trump told the Washington Examiner last month. Very, very unfair. Ivanka Trump's private discussions with the committee come as lawyers for the panel are also in talks with another potential key witness, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who helped lead the effort to overturn the results of the 2020 election. During those discussions, Giuliani's lawyer has made clear to the committee that the former New York mayor does not intend to provide information against Trump, under the argument that it would violate attorney-client privilege and Trump's claims of executive privilege, but he is considering providing information about his dealings with members of Congress, according to a person familiar with the talks. As the Capitol was under siege, Giuliani and Trump called lawmakers to delay the certification of Joe Biden's victory. The committee thus far has treated Ivanka Trump with deference, seeking only her voluntary cooperation, insisting that its members respect her privacy and emphasizing that its questions would be limited to events directly related to the January 6th attack. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.